so we just take our credit cards out. But with antennas, there's a lot of models that are for sale, and it's not that difficult to go down to Home Depot and get some wire and rig something yourself. So everyone, think of doing that. You know, it's loads of fun, especially if you're successful. It gives you a great deal of satisfaction.
Chet, the P2AA state.
Yes, Chet?
Yeah, hey. Hi, everybody. Yeah, I've been using for the last year my best antenna that I built over 60 years is the fan dipole for me, because I have a small backyard. And it's for 40, 20, and 10. And I did leave about a foot or so at the ends. And it's in the inverted V configuration. I put the 40 on the top. It's all one feed line, and everything comes from the same point. You know, the feed line feeds all three wires. But at the ends of each element for 40, 20, and 10, I separated the wires by around about a foot or so, maybe 20 inches. And it wasn't important exactly, as long as, as the gentleman just said, you keep the angle of the inverted V at least 90 degrees. If you put up the inverted V less than 90 degrees, you got a major decrease in signal. So just make sure that you have the angle at least 90 degrees. And I have to tell you, it was the easiest antenna to tune up. I can't believe it, how easy it was. I started tuning it to 40. I had pulleys, so I can go up and down real easy. I did that, got pretty much a one-to-one. Then I did the 20-meter antenna, same thing. Then I went back to 40 just to get the SWR check on it after I tuned the 20 antenna. And the 40-meter SWR didn't change. I said, this is wonderful. Then I tuned up to 10 and got that about 1.3 or something, I think it was. I said, that's good enough. But it was very easy to tune, and all you have to do is add about, when you're building the fan dipole, and let's just say you end up with 16 on a 20-meter antenna, let's say, for argument's sake, 16.3 inches or something like that. Always make the fan dipole, when you're putting it up, about a foot longer. Make the wire about a foot longer. This way you could cut the wire shorter to get the tuning. So never cut the wire exactly as if, you know, you did the 468 over megacycles and feet. That's not a very good idea. Always leave extra wire and prune. And I am so happy with my fan dipole. I love it. And I'm so happy. All I can tell you, it is wonderful. Over.
KC2GS. Yeah, I'm a big fan of fan dipoles as well. There's the old adage that it's far easier to shorten an antenna than to lengthen an antenna. So cut it long. And personally, I think you're better off if you kind of bend it back on itself, so that you still have that excess piece of wire if you ever need to retune it for some reason.
In my case, I did double it back, and I spent up a year. I didn't have to retune. It's holding steady. All right. WP2AHK.
Okay, very good. Yeah, always. It's better to have plan B, C, D, and E and not need it than just to kind of do whatever and see what happens to you. But, yeah, I would agree. If you're going to cut it long, shorten it by twisting it back on itself. You may never need to readjust it, but if you do need to readjust it, the excess is already sitting there. You don't have to start doing mechanically weak splices to lengthen your antenna. So good design. There's a lot of great designs for antennas, but fan dipoles serves my purpose more than any of the others and fit in my little 20 by 50 foot bit of Brooklyn. Any other comments?
Yeah, just one. Have you heard of the, I'll call it the theorem. It's a, I'm not sure the right word is, but if you ground an antenna at DC, that it'll have less noise. Have you heard that before?
I think I've heard that before, but for the life of me, I can't even recall where I heard that. It was more of an anecdotal type of thing. It's one of those things that I'm going to have to kind of rummage through Google search, see if I could unearth some resource articles on the subject.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, when I was back in high school, and I assure you that was more than 50 years ago, we had a 80-meter dipole strung across the school roof, and on a windy day, the RG-8 that connected to that thing would arc over. Just because of the wind blowing.
Yeah. Static electricity charges, all kinds of fun stuff. I have a Wilmshurst generator sitting next to me. So, yeah, static electricity, wind can kind of do interesting things with electrons.
Yeah, I'm just surprised it doesn't seem to be more in the ham literature about that, because I think that any attempt to improve the signal-to-noise ratio of the antenna itself will help just about everything you do with it.
Yeah, I would agree, but I don't remember seeing it in the handbook or the even the antenna handbook.
I guess I'm going to go and do some digging, but thanks. Appreciate the help. WB2IKT.
Comment?
You're welcome. Yeah.
Yeah, on that wind thing, I used to have, when I was a kid, I had a long wire antenna. And I had a neon bulb with a, 100K resistor in series with the antenna to ground. And you could see that damn bulb blink every so often on a windy day. It's very impressive.
Yeah. We most of the time, we don't really appreciate the phenomena that's happening all around us because we're insensitive to it.
WB2AHK.
Yeah, Chad?
An example, I had a 160-meter antenna hanging up in the air. I did a lot of 160. And it was, I had a 128-foot tower. I was lucky I had that at work. I put it up a ham radio. And anyway, I have to warn people, be careful. If a storm is coming, if a thunderstorm is coming and you see lightning, keep away from your antenna. I was on the roof during the storm is starting to come. I figure I'm unable to be electrocuted because I'm different. I'm the American Ham Kid, American Ham King, and the hell with the storm, nothing to worry about. Well, anyway, I had the antenna on pulleys, and for some reason, I decided to touch. I was up on top of the tower, and there was no radio on. Happened to be up there. I don't know what I was doing up there. And I said, let me get the heck out off the tower. But somehow or other, I touched the transmitting antenna. Whoa! I'm glad I had my retainer belt on. Boy, did I get zapped! But Benjamin Franklin said that he could gather electricity from the air. Boy, oh boy, you can really get zapped if the antenna is long enough. Be careful, guys. All right.
Yes, indeed. It's always good to respect physics, because physics will out, We don't have quite the same problem with high voltage in our shacks because most of our equipment these days are transistor and relatively lower voltage than the old, good old vacuum tubes. But, you know, electricity can and does kill people every year. Well, Jim, well, what's your question tonight?
Okay, well, excuse my chewing on my foot. Digital ham seems becoming a thing. Seems to be becoming a thing. And there's lots of different with DMR. Yaesu has their version. I think it's the third version. Different stuff like that. But apparently there's a thing called Pre-DV, Pre-Digital Voice, that works on a single sideband mode. It's open source, and it, some people think it could change the whole radio world as significantly as single sideband did. Can anybody add to that conversation? It's an interesting topic. I don't truly understand it, but it's of interest. Over you, Roy.
WB2IKT. If you join the Limark meeting this coming Wednesday, that is the presentation for the night.
You're doing a presentation on free DV?
No, sir, I am not doing it. We've invited Munir Salem. He's a K6. He'll be coming in via Zoom, and he's one of the developers of the radio auto encoder, which is our ADE, and one of the principals of the free DV movement. And he'll be talking to Limark this Wednesday via Zoom. He'll be in California, but the rest of us will be in Levittown Hall. So via Zoom or be it at the hall, but don't miss this one if you're interested in it.
Ah, very, very timely. So it's, Jim, scribble that down. FreeDV is another voice encoder, decoder algorithm that's open source. My understanding is a guy earned his PhD in the field by writing it as a thesis. So it, unlike the other modes, the D-Star, D-Star and Fusion and DMV, all use a commercial encoder decoder for phonemes for voice. It reduces the fragments of your words into digital shorthand and encode them in some method of phase shift keying and then packet utilization. And FreeDV happens to be open source so that you don't have to get a license from anyone to use it. It's been around for a while. I had a FreeDV modulator, demodulator for my Flex. Had to be 6 years ago when they were promoting software add-ons to the Flex, and it was FreeDV. But also D-Star, which is usually through ICOM, allows you to use their digital encoding system on the HF band. They made it available on their radios maybe 5 years ago, and it never really took off. So I'm not quite sure if the world is particularly waiting for a digital HF mode. The overwhelming majority of digital transmissions are usually UHF and VHF these days. You know, anything can happen.
I've been finding it most interesting that it seems to be these modes can operate below the noise floor, where rather than trying to tower over the noise that's in the around us, they work within. And then add the open source plus to the whole thing. It sounds like a very interesting concept.
Okay, I think you're mixing two different things together. Below noise transmissions and such are usually what people describe Joe Taylor's set of computer algorithms. In that case, it's not a voice transmission. It's a very, very low symbol rate, maybe about 5 words a minute. So it's a low symbol rate because there's redundancy and there's error correction code embedded in it. And that's JT type of algorithms as opposed to the ones that are voice mode. That don't really, as far as I'm aware, I mean, there are people who suggest that you'll get a little bit farther using digital voice modes than analog voice modes. I've never seen that fundamentally proved experimentally, but, you know, some people like it, some people don't. Some people really are upset by the audio artifacts based on the different technologies used to compress the audio stream. Eric used to say that there were some versions of digital voice that he preferred over others because the artifacts with some of them were just very annoying to him and his hearing aid.
A broad free DV site. There is an excellent IEEE quality paper on exactly how it works. It's using a so-called Fargon vocoder. The result is that it takes up 1.5 kilohertz of RF spectrum. The audio frequency response is 100 hertz to 8 kilohertz. Now, let me see some other things. Yeah, the peak-to-average power ratio has been adjusted, so it's basically very similar. The peak power is within a dB or so of the average power. And it's also very easy to tune in, so it's actually easier to use than sideband. I personally have the feeling it's probably going to take over the world and displace sideband, but I also think it's going to take a long time to do that, and I'm giving it maybe 10 to 15 years, and then we'll see the majority of folks on that instead of sideband. All right?
Okay, very good. You know, DMV uses time slicing. They have narrowed their bandwidth as well. I'm not really sure if any of these, well, you know far better than me about this particular subject, but do they mention that they're capable of receiving signals below the noise floor like JT algorithms can do?
They're not making that claim, and the reason why is that in order to receive a signal below the noise floor, it has to be a recursive signal. And voice signals, as we, you know, human speech, not recorded stuff, but human speech doesn't have that characteristic. So I don't think it's possible. But they have demos on 20 meters of 20-meter conversations, sideband and digital, and the difference is astounding. And you can just go and click on those demos. They're right on the website, freedv.org. Go look at it. It's well worth it.
Okay, very well. So, Jim, if you're very interested, you could jump on Zoom and listen to the presentation.
Sounds like I was more relevant than I had thought. I'll look into that. It's interesting that I like the open source nature of the thing. I like the fact that it sounds like it works well. A lot of these digital voice things are all proprietary. I don't know why that happened. It seems so antithetical to what amateur radio is. Like these different brands would come up with their own private digital formats. It seems ridiculous. It's doomed to fail. Anyway, thanks for the feedback. I think it sounds like I hit on a nerve. I'll be looking. Thank you.
Okay,
just
very good. Well,
keep in mind those brands are actually selling amateur as almost their hobby to sell those things. They're making money off of it, and the patents are their paywalls so that they do make money. but it's on the commercial side that they're selling, and they're competing against everybody else commercially. So they're going to be different, because commercially they think they have an advantage. And on the ham side, that's the advantage is trivial, but you're right. It's resulted in fragmentation of the ham market. And I kind of hope that free TV movement can fix that.
And keep in mind, there's another movement called M17.
That's mentioned on the Free TV page, and I think they're incorporating that. Time will tell.
Yeah, there's a bit of action going on UHF, VHF. Connect Systems is trying to market a HD that's capable of M17. It uses the same open source voice encoder decoder. I think the algorithms are different, or you know, subject to change. There's been a little bit of an argument among M17 and people surrounding it that you know, that are making noise about it. So you know, I don't exactly know if it's a frozen or still subject to some adjustment.
So there's a lot going on in this particular field, sounds like.
Yeah, there's a lot of research and development. There's a lot of experimentation. The bottom line, unfortunately, amounts to, will the amateur consumer invest in it or not? If not, then, you know, there's some. There's always been great technological advances that never found an audience, and so it just faded away. So, you know, stay tuned, and we'll see what happens. I sort of agree that nothing's going to kind of change overnight here. There's way too many guys set in their ways.
I agree with you. Just let me just quick finish with the good news is that you can use any existing single sideband rig with this technology. The computer can, you know, plug into the audio chain on it. And it works very similar to FT8 in terms of how you hook it up. So if you can hook up FT8 to your radio, you can hook up Free TV, and most of the procedure is the same. Let the computer do the talking and let the radio do the radioing. How's that for a closing thing? This is WB2IKT.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, we'll see how things work out. You know, it had to be 6 or 7 years ago, Flex actually released, they used to call them waveform files, and you could actually install it and use something that at least they called Free DV protocols. I never really experimented much with it. The waveform feature, Flex Radio never got enough feedback from users to keep maintaining it, so they kind of pulled the whole idea about 6 months later. Anyway, Jim, thank you for bringing up the subject. You know, there's always going to be new technology at the edges of our hobby. There's thankfully enough clever people out there trying to figure out how to reinvent the wheel and to make it even nicer than it was and is. Anyway, this is AC2GS with the Limock Technical Net. If anyone has any questions, comments, or topics for tonight, please hit that push to talk and ID.
This is Kilo Romeo 4 Golf Echo November checking in.
Hello there. Yeah, I see you on the Echo Link, I believe.
That is correct. My name is Bill. I'm in Parkland, Florida.
Very good. Do you have any questions or comments or topics for us tonight, Bill?
Well, I've been monitoring the net for a while. Tonight, my wife and I went outside to see the ISS pass by because it was coming right by us. So this is a first for us. I'm a new operator, as you know. And it was interesting. I did not listen to any VHF response from it. We weren't monitoring the satellite, but I've been monitoring the net and enjoying the technical aspects of it. And wanted to thank you guys and who's on the net. Back to you.
Well, you're certainly welcome, Bill. Thank you for listening and for participating. We appreciate that as well. Well, once again, I'm AC2GS. We still have a bunch of time if you want to use it. It's only 9:30. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics that they'd like to roll around tonight, science and technology related, feel free, hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
WP2AHK.
Yes.
All right. WP2AHK. Years ago, a friend of mine who passed away, Silent Key, he worked for a radio company, radio service company, had a state contract with the state police, New York State Police, and he was in charge of a stretch of areas where he would keep the communication system for the New York State police. And they had simulcasting. Did you ever hear anything about simulcasting? I think it was on 2 meters. Well, not the 2 meters, but it was on VHF. Were you aware that on certain main channels, statewide channels, not that the whole state is simulcast, but they were able to keep all, on certain frequencies, all the radios aligned exactly, and they could simulcast the same message all over the whole state. Are you aware of that, Roy, or anybody else?
Well, I personally wasn't aware of that. Anyone else knew that?
This is N2A AM.
Yeah?
Yeah, okay, this is N2A AM. My name is Dave. I'm in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, and how does the simulcast, one of the systems out there that simulcast, you can have, let's say you have six repeaters which cover the entire region that you want to cover, and you can have them all transmit on the same frequency. Now, the problem is when you go from coverage range of site to site, it could cause cancellations of signals and things like that. How they get around it is lock all the transmitters to a single reference, and what they use is GPS, and they lock them to a GPS reference, and that keeps all the transmitters online, properly aligned, so that there are no problems as the user goes from range to range of the different stations that are in the system. That's how I understand that one of the simulcast systems works.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I remember Andy, WA2CDL, was working as a contract guy from a big company to work on the subway systems communication centers. And I remember him telling me that they use GPS systems to time lock the different stations there. So maybe something vaguely similar is going on.
Yeah, possibly. And just if I can inject another comment on the RAID digital codec that you were talking about before.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm interested in that as well, and I've followed the digital voice thing for a good number of years. I don't do it on HF, but I've experimented with DMR and D-Star and APCO 25, etc. I have heard the demos of the new RAID codec for free DV, and it is mind-boggling. You can still hear a little bit of artifacts, but it blows away all previous versions of 3DB, and the sound will surprise you. It's very understandable, and if you go to the site and listen to the samples. It will blow you away when you consider the comparison between that and the single sideband. And how they, by the way, how they transmit is they use OFDM, which is they split the carrier into small bits, and they have maybe, I don't know what the amount of frequencies they use, but they have a series of, if you will, bits, and they use different carriers, audio sub-carriers within the main carrier, and they, I think they're 50 hertz apiece, or something like that, and they modulate them. So it's really interesting, and it'll be definitely something into looking at in the future for ham radio. And the neat thing about it is open source. But I'm not the expert, but I just figured I'd toss that bit in. This is N2AM, back to that.
Yeah, it's getting more and more interesting. Yeah, it apparently uses orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, which I think is one of the things going on with digital cell phones as well. You know, we're thankfully getting into the 21st century here, so I really have to look that stuff up.
Yeah, that's true. It is interesting. And I hope to play with that in the future, because it's just a matter of downloading the software and putting it on the computer and testing it out. And it's mind blowing that they could do this in a bandwidth of 1500 hertz, which is the real mind blowing thing. And I'd be curious on how robust it is in terms of interference, noise resistance, et cetera. So I'd be curious about that as well. Anyway, back to that. This is N2AM.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll have to kind of peruse that. I'm always willing to download another program to my desktop, and it's already wired in with my radio, so shouldn't be a problem at all. So we'll see what they got cooking there. Yeah, it's very infrequently that we discuss a brand new topic, but, you know, the old free DV was kind of a little bit more of the same as D-Star and DMR and Fusion and such, so this seems to be a kind of a new generation, because I think the original free DV was primarily just very simple. Situation based again on a guy's PhD thesis from God knows maybe 15 years ago. Anyway, any other comments out there?
On free DV, you could also look at YouTube, because there's apparently a growing inventory of YouTube demos of what it does, and you know, just do a search for it, and wow, it's impressive. It really is. WB2IKT.
Okay, yeah, there's always YouTube. Although YouTube's a little dangerous sometimes. You know, about 50% of the amateur radio YouTubes, it's guys who kind of are a little bit delusional. You know, 50% are wonderful, very smart guys, very knowledgeable guys, very generous with their information. But some guys are just, I don't know, they're spinning their wheels for the sake of, I guess, AdSense or what, who knows. Anyway, any other comments before we move on?
Oh, I'm on their website, and there is a graph of signal-to-noise ratio versus packet loss. And apparently the packet loss is about 0.175 at a signal-to-noise ratio of, if I'm reading this graph right, probably about 2 dB. So if your signal-to-noise ratio is 2 dB or better, this thing ought to work just wonderfully.
Yeah, okay. I mean, if you know, I mean, is there, or anyone else, is there actual practical software I could download on my PC and get it running, you know, by tomorrow, or is it still in a very raw state?
I think there are experimental versions that you can go and download. They're written in several languages, one of which is Python. I forgot what the other ones were.
Okay, I'll have to take a look. Unfortunately, a lot of very good experimental stuff is kind of written for Linux. And although I have some Raspberry Pis, I'm not exactly a Linux wizard, so I usually wait until they put a Windows code on it.
There is a Windows version, a Linux version, and I think as well as the one for Mac. This is N2AM.
Oh, okay, I'll have to hunt it down and take a look at it and then see if I can convince anyone else into going on the air on the other side and, you know, banging on it a little bit and seeing how it works.
WB2AHK.
Yes, Chet?
Well, I like the idea about the street DB. I have to find out more. Sounds like I might be interested in that. I just want to relay something. Seems like you have a little bit of time on your hands here. I'd like to talk about past experiences of fun experimentation that I had on 160 meters. Take about 10 minutes if you have that kind of time. If not, I'll do it some other time. Go ahead.
Sure, we have the time, Chet.
All right. So back, I ended in 2013, but I was on 160 meters for about 19 years on AM. And I had a great signal on 160, as I mentioned before, at the 128-foot tower. I had a big, beautiful antenna, full size on 160. And I operated the station from 7 miles away on a link. I call it a STL, studio transmitter, a link on UHF. I sent the UHF signal, and I could turn the station on and off and change frequencies and do all kinds of wonderful things. Because I had an antenna in my backyard for 160, a 5-foot loop, receiving loop, it was a great antenna. I had a great receiver here. I could hear my signal like 40 over 9 from where I was transmitting. I mean, depthful quieting. Let me let it drop. So anyhow, we had a great bunch of people on there, a lot of broadcast engineers and so on. There, at times we had like 10 guys on the frequency of 1885, all AM. And I did some experiments. I was full duplex, absolutely full duplex. That means I could transmit and receive on 160 with my AM station. Of course, some people didn't believe that, and they tested me over the air while I was talking. I could hear them underneath me saying, "Oh, he's not duplex, he's full of it." And then I say, "Oh, I hear you guys," and I didn't drop the carrier. And I say, "Okay, give me a mathematical question, and I'll answer it." And I didn't drop my carrier. I'm still transmitting. And they gave me a question, something simple, like how much is 30 times 5 or something like that. And I answered the question while I was still transmitting with my transmitter from my location. So I was full duplex. Then the funny thing happened. When we did some experiments, and when somebody had a great big signal, I would zero beat them. Absolutely, I could change the frequency of my transmitter. I could absolutely zero beat the station that was transmitting at that moment. And I could swear that they were modulating. I wasn't talking at that moment on my station transmitter. I just had the carrier on, and they were modulating my signal. Their signal was modulating my signal. That's a true story. So I thought that was very interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, the hijinks on 160 meters. Who would think? Well, I mean, I could understand why they would doubt you. I mean, it's not an everyday accomplishment that you accomplished.
So I was thinking, if I had four stations, this is just an experimentation for fun. If there was four stations, they were all hearing themselves loud and clear, equal amounts of the signal getting sent, being sent to everybody, everybody with strong signals. And if we had a central station, let's say if I still had that setup, which I don't have, and if I was transmitting and everybody's coming in extremely strong, they could all not only use their own station to transmit a signal, they would modulate my signal and they'd have even a bigger signal to transmit. I thought that might be a lot of fun.
Yeah, did you ever accomplish that?
No, I didn't. I know that I had people coming in while I was transmitting. I could hear them loud and clear, you know, talking under me. They were making, of course, they were making comments about me, you know. Oh, yeah, you know. But you know, just for fun, they were making comments about me. That's okay. I could take it. But I was thinking that would be a great experiment someday to have like a central station for people who have, stations that are strong and modulate somebody else's transmitter. That could be fun. And I would imagine if the central station had a good antenna, he could increase the range of all the stations in the net. Go ahead.
You could kind of have a super station built on everything on your station and such. It's a shame you never got around to doing it. It's not like there's a lot of guys on 160, but. They tend to be technologically savvy guys, so you know it's a shame you can't kind of go to some 160 meter forum and kind of tell them your little story, see if you could get them to kind of reinvent that.
Well, unfortunately, I sold my site in 2013, and the towers are gone now. But I do remember a funny story, if everybody wants to laugh. I was running boat anchor transmitters at the time. I had three boat anchor transmitters and two amplifiers there at the station. And I was able, I hooked up motor drives to the VFO knob. And I had motor drives to the modulation parts on two of them, and by remote control, I could change frequencies on 160 meters with boat anchors, and I could also adjust my AM modulation by turning the parts with the motor drives. But anyway, I was on 80 meters once. Instead of the 160, I got to 80 meters. There was a big net on 180, it was 3885. And it was my turn. It was like, geez, it's like a round table that takes like 2 hours to get back to the original guy. So it was my turn. I had my Viking Valiant on, and that one, I did not break much on 75 meters, but I was there that night. And I'm talking on my Viking Valiant. I'm hearing myself full duplex from my house 7 miles away. And I turned the transmitter on, and there he goes yakking away. All of a sudden, I'm hearing noises on my Viking Valiant, live over the air 7 miles away, and the Valiant was going, was making noises, and all of a sudden they went off the air about 30 seconds later. The next morning when I went to where my location was to see what happened, I found out the Viking Valiant, the Viking Valiant's main wiring harness burnt up. And they went on fire. I was talking with about 15 other guys on the frequency, and they didn't know it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that always concerns me about remote operations, that I'm always a little worried that, you know, electricity can do funny things to equipment. So, you know, I've never actually worked completely remotely, but I've always said in the back of my mind that, you know, you're taking a bit of a risk.
Yeah, then CQ magazine offered to come about 6 months later to do a story on my station and took photographs. I was featured in November 2012 in CQ magazine. I was also in 2013 on CQ magazine's calendar for the year 2013. But anyway, I sort of my pictures in CQ magazine of me standing in front of all the wires going everywhere with three low-band transmitters, two amplifiers, and so on. Pictures of me sitting on the roof next to my towers. I had four towers there. But anyway, the transmitting room didn't look wonderful. It's not like good housekeeping approved, because I was adding things all over the place. Kept on adding things. Only me could figure out what's wrong. And anyway, shortly after the CQ magazine went out, I was embarrassed by how I looked standing in the doorway of my transmitting room with all the stuff all over the place. I went solid state on 160 and got rid of all my boat anchors. I gave everything away about a year or two later and went solid state with a K7 DYY, a senior solid state transmitter, which put out 250 watts carrier. And about a year or two later, he came out with a super senior with full legal limit power. So I went to solid state and got rid of my boat anchors, and there went away the liability of transmitters going on fire when I wasn't there.
Yes, indeed. All's well that ends well. So I'm glad it had a happy ending.
With that, 7-3s.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a shame. CQ magazine is no more. The publisher, I think, just eventually he passed away. It was on its last legs long before that. They had skipped publishing all kinds of issues. And then when he passed away, I don't think anyone wanted to take it, so it just faded into memory. Okey-doke, once again, this is AC2GS with the Limelark Technical Net. We still have a little free time if you want to use it. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, feel free to hit that push to talk and put your name on the list.
KD2BHD, a small topic.
Okay, Jim?
The new and improved ICOM IC7300 Mark II with a receive antenna jack and some other neat features. Any thoughts?
It sounds like it's a very nice iteration on the original 7300. Primarily, most people, I think, are going to be drawn to the improved receiver circuitry. I don't know if that many people are going to be that swayed by the fact that it has a HDMI cable connector instead of a DVI, or that it has a Ethernet connection, or that it has two USB-C connectors. I'm sure there'll be a few, but I think it's going in the right direction. Unfortunately, people get tired of models, and as successful as the Mark I has been, it probably is very smart on their part to develop and manufacture the Mark II. The big question I have is what's going to happen to the price. I think it's going to live or die by the price point that they select for it. And especially these days with the weird tariff situation, I don't know how they could figure that out, because it changes about every hour and a half.
Good point. That's highly relevant. I'm enjoying the fact that it seems like there's a growing ability for the manufacturers of lots of things to get feedback from the actual consumers and incorporate it into their products. I'm enjoying that. It's always been like a kind of a gatekeeper thing that seems to be breaking down a bit. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not quite sure of how much they got from the public or not. Japanese brands are sort of infamous for being very conservative. They move very slowly, but you know they don't go off on any kind of weird tangent. But it's very much like ICOM did, I don't know, 15 years ago with the 706, and they gave us the 706 Mark II, which was very popular. You know, when I got into the hobby, there were a lot of guys who, among other radios that they had on in their shack, one of them was almost always an ICOM 706 Mark II. So I think they've sort of been doing this since long before, you know, any interest in the public, what they wanted, what they didn't want. So I'm not quite sure how much the public played a part in the Mark II.
Well, I hope they did. I hope there's a feedback loop that's growing that as it should.
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to be able to know because, you know, most of these companies are very close to the vest. They don't really talk a lot. You know, marketing just buzzes with marketing words, but otherwise you don't really have any legitimate, you know, there is no kind of Elon Musk of ICOM out there. They're a corporate entity as far as I'm aware.
Fair enough, but you see it in the Chinese products where Chinese manufacturers are selling, for example, Bofang radios. They're responding to YouTubers and changing their product lines to meet the collective asks of a much wider group of people than is normal and in our lifetime. I think it's a very interesting situation.
Yeah, okay, we'll see how things develop. But, you know, I think of Chinese culturally, ethnically, not quite the same as Japanese. They're both Asian people, but with very different senses of behavior and such. So, yeah, Chinese will just, you know, if there's money to be made, they'll make whatever adjustments they have to sell as much of a product as they can. Whereas Japanese kind of have a slightly less capitalist attitude towards their products. I see them taking a bit more pride and not really changing things unless they feel they need to be changed. It's more difficult to kind of talk a Japanese manufacturer into a different product than, say, a Chinese manufacturer.
I concur on everything you said, but the bigger picture of human culture ebbs and flows where the common people can put some feedback back into the system or not. And we've been at a lull in that, and it seems like that's growing. I'm seeing it in radios. You know, some knucklehead YouTuber collaborates a consensus, says something on his YouTube channel, and a giant manufacturer in China responds. That's new.
Okay. Again, I think it's one of the positive aspects of Chinese manufacturing. They can kind of turn on a dime because all of the components, everything that you can imagine, is within you know, a mile or two of any other factory. It's kind of amazing they have these massive supply chains that you don't have to wait for a slow boat going across the ocean. So I think it's one of the pluses of the matter that Chinese manufacturing uses to kind of be very flexible, sometimes overly flexible. You know, if there's a market for anything, they'll throw in and and try it, even though it's going to fail. They'll tempt fate. Much more likely than more conservative manufacturers that have a long-term responsibility. You know, they have a heritage. Chinese manufacturing really doesn't have that heritage yet, because these are all new industries. I mean, it used to annoy the heck out of me, the handy talkies that would come out of China. Each of them had a different brand name. I couldn't keep them straight until they kind of settled out and became very few and memorable, as opposed to, you know, every other week it was a King Feng, a Wang Hu, a Gao Lang. You know, you kind of had to do, I thought they just kind of made them up by putting them in a little pot and just kind of reaching for syllables.
No argument there.
Yes, indeed. Well, we'll see. Hopefully these tariffs will kind of dissipate, and we'll be able to get things. I don't know about any of you guys, but I recently tried to purchase a very small item. I think it was maybe $12 or $13. Unfortunately, they just weren't selling them in the United States, and the closest place I could find was Canada, which used to be fine. It didn't cost almost anything different between here and Canada. And sure enough, I put the damn thing in my cart and immediately had a page tell me that due to the de minimis law being canceled, and they didn't really know how to bill anyone with tariffs and such, so they simply said that they weren't shipping to the United States for the time being. So they lost the sale. I lost the opportunity to buy something that has yet to be imported into the United States, and the tariffs just keep on coming.
I'll refrain. Great night tonight.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else have any comments tonight before we move on to the next segment?
BD2BXO.
Hello, Frank. How are you tonight?
Okay. Got on a bit late because my wife and I are celebrating our I think it's 17th wedding anniversary, but anyway, it's here now. Couple of things. First of all, I heard you mention the digital mode. Is that 3 Delta Vista or 3 Delta Papa? I do want to look that up. Go ahead.
I believe it's 3 as in Foxtrot, Romeo.
As soon as I get my phone to drop the carrier.
I hear you, Frank. WS2N. Maybe Roy dropped out.
No, I'm here, but unfortunately, Frank got stuck on Echo Lake. It's not disengaging.
Okay, understood.
I think it's working a little better now. Let's see if it drops this touch.
Yeah, it dropped. What was the question again? It's been so long.
I was asking, what was the designation of this open source voice mode? Was it 3 Delta Victor, 3 Delta Papa? I wasn't clear on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's Foxtrot, Romeo, Echo, Echo. It's not 3 the number, it's 3. As in, you don't have to pay any manufacturer to use their algorithm. And then it's It's a digital voice, so D, Delta Victor.
Oh, okay, yeah, I've heard of that before. I think you may have talked about that a year or two ago. All right, I'll look into that.